Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. Today we go back into the classroom for an English lesson on causatives. Do you know what they are? Everything you need to know is just ahead. Then you can use what you learned as we talk about a recent decision that affects one of the world's largest organizations for boys. We've got a lot to do today, so let's get started with Jill Robbins and Part 1.
This week's Everyday Grammar looks at the grammatical forms called causatives. Basically, causatives express how one actor causes another actor to do something. You know the meaning of make, as in, I made a cake. But in the sentence, my boss made me work late, make has a causative meaning. In other words, my boss forced me to work late. A causative sentence starts with a subject, followed by a causative verb, then an object noun or pronoun, and then the simple form of the verb. Three of the most common causatives in English are make, have, and get.
In the book Understanding and Using English Grammar, Betty Azar explains it this way. X makes Y do something. That is, X forces Y to do something. X has Y do something. This means X requests that Y do something. X gets Y to do something. This means X persuades Y to do something. Let's start with the causative make. As we mentioned before, make means that X forces Y to do something. The meaning of the causative make is stronger than have and get. We often hear the causative form of make in love songs. Listen for the causative as Elton John sings.
What do I do to make you love me? Oh, what am I gotta do to be heard?
Elton knows, however, it is impossible. You cannot make someone love you.
In the movie As Good As It Gets, actors Jack Nicholson and Helen Hunt play a couple falling in love. Listen to this dramatic compliment from Nicholson's character, Melvin Udall.
Okay. Now, I got a real great compliment for you, and it's true. You make me want to be a better man.
That's maybe the best compliment of my life.
Melvin's statement is possible. She made or caused him to want to change. Now let's look at the causative meaning of have. For example, I had her cut my hair. You can also use have to tell about a request, as in, I had him carry the bag for me. In other words, I requested that he carry my bag. A common mistake is using the infinitive verb form with make or have. You should not say, I made my cat to do a trick. The correct sentence is, I made my cat do a trick. It is easy to get confused because this sentence is very close to a correct sentence. I taught my cat to do a trick. This is a case where you just have to remember that make and have, when used as causatives, act differently from other verbs.
Finally, let's talk about get. The verb get is used in many ways, but as a causative, it means to persuade someone to do something they may not want to do. For example, I got my son to clean his room. As a causative, get works the same way as make and have. The difference is, get is followed by an infinitive with to. Notice the infinitive to eat in this sentence. We got the kids to eat the broccoli. While reporting about the new climate plan, a journalist wrote, President Obama wants Americans to save energy and lower greenhouse gases. To do that, he must get them to give up their SUVs. In other words, Obama must persuade Americans to stop driving SUVs. You might have noticed that with both make and have, the following verb is in the base form. There is no to. However, after the causative verb get, the following verb is in the infinitive with to. For example, I got my boss to give me a raise.
I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to VOA from Washington. The Boy Scouts of America has canceled its policy barring openly gay adults from serving as scout leaders and employees. The policy was set up to keep boys away from homosexuals, people who are sexually interested in members of the same sex. Now that is changing. Christopher Jones Cruz tells us more about the recent decision.
The Boy Scouts announcement may be an attempt by the 105-year-old organization to stop falling membership. Observers say it is also aimed at satisfying the demands of religious groups while at the same time avoiding legal action. They say the organization's leadership is concerned about possible court cases by gay rights activists. Robert Gates is the president of the Boy Scouts of America. He served as Secretary of Defense for two presidents, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Mr. Gates spoke about the decision shortly after it was announced.
For far too long, this issue has divided and distracted us. Now it's time to unite behind our shared belief in the extraordinary power of scouting to be a force for good.
Some Christian leaders criticized the decision. One of them was Robert Jeffress. He heads the First Baptist Church, Dallas, in Texas.
Remember, it was just a few years ago that the Boy Scouts were forced to release 14,000 pages of documents, the so-called perversion files, that detailed thousands of sexual assault cases of troop leaders against Boy Scouts.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints supports more Boy Scout units than any other religious group. Members of the church are known as Mormons. After the decision was announced, the group released a statement. It said the church's 100-year-long relationship with the Boy Scouts of America will need to be examined. Some religious groups are urging their members to send their boys to organizations other than the Boy Scouts. One such group is Trail Life USA. Its website says Trail Life USA has links to Christian groups in almost every state. It says the morals and values of our country are deteriorating and are becoming increasingly opposed to true Christian values. However, some parents support the Boy Scouts of America's decision. Oliver Tessier is the father of a boy who is an Eagle Scout. That is the highest level of scouting.
You're taught to be honest, you're taught to be trustworthy, you're taught to be generous, caring. Discrimination is none of those things.
The new policy took effect as soon as it was announced. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Have you ever thought about screaming? A blood-curdling scream is a natural reaction to sudden, extreme fright. When people hear a truly disturbing scream, they usually respond quickly. But why are screams so useful in warning us of danger? New research helps to explain why screaming is disturbing and useful. Screams like those we hear in horror movies have a special quality that separates them from other noises we make and hear. These screams are recognized by people all over the world. People of all cultures and languages hear the same thing in a scream: fear.
Every kid in every culture screams. Every adult in the context of a true fear response screams. So it's genuinely a feature of the human mind and brain.
David Poppel is a neuroscientist at New York University. He wondered why screams are recognized the same way by people all around the world. So he and his colleagues set up an experiment. They recorded screams from movies and from volunteers who took part in the research. The scientists, however, did not measure the screams for loudness or pitch. Instead, they measured how quickly the sounds in the scream changed in volume. It was in this area, the change in volume, where screams stand apart from other sounds. The researchers found that screams occupy a special part of the acoustic or sound spectrum that other sounds do not. Professor Poppel says screams have a reserved place, a niche.
It turned out that screams occupy this unique niche in the acoustic spectrum that's actually not used by other sounds, so they really have a reserved place.
Sounds are described in terms of their frequency. Frequency is measured in hertz. Normal speech changes in volume at a low rate, about 4 to 5 hertz or cycles per second. Screams, however, change in volume very quickly and very widely, from 30 hertz up to 150 hertz. When the volume of a sound changes that quickly, it has a quality called roughness. The more roughness a sound has, the more worrying it is. David Poppel and his team found that car alarms, sirens, and alarm clocks also have this quality, this roughness. The scientists then studied how this roughness changed brain activity. They asked the volunteers to listen to different types of screams and alarms in an MRI scanner. The researchers found that the greater roughness of a sound, the more it activates the amygdala. The amygdala is an area deep in the brain that answers to fear.
The amygdala acts like a gauge that says, wow, this sound has a lot of roughness in it. That's particularly alarming and scary.
Screams, it turns out, are a direct link to the part of our brain that tells us if we should be afraid or not. Now we know why a scream gets so much attention so quickly. I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we complete the story of the American Revolution. The time is December 1776. British General William Howe has decided to stop fighting during the cold winter months. The general is in New York. He has already established control of a few areas near the city, including Trenton and Princeton in New Jersey. General George Washington and the Continental Army are on the other side of the Delaware River. The Americans are cold and hungry. They have few weapons. Washington knows that if Howe attacks, the British will be able to go all the way to Philadelphia.
He's looking at his army, which is melting away.
Historian Gordon Wood says that moment was the low point of the war for George Washington.
And he decides to make one great effort on Christmas night and crosses the Delaware, dead of winter, cold, ice, and he crosses and attacks Trenton, where you have about 1,000 Hessians who are kind of overwhelmed and defeated. It's a small tactical victory, but a great psychological effect, because it's the first time that Washington had actually done something positive, and it really does, I think, change the psychology of the war.
Another result of the victory at Trenton was that more men decided to join the army. It now had 10,000 soldiers. This new Continental Army, however, lost battles during the summer to General Howe's forces near the Chesapeake Bay. And in August 1777, General Howe captured Philadelphia. Following these losses, Washington led the army to the nearby area of Pennsylvania called Valley Forge.
Valley Forge was the camp where George Washington and his army spent a really miserable, miserable winter.
Alice Camps is a curator at the National Archives in Washington, where some of the country's most important documents are kept. One of those documents is a letter that George Washington wrote from Valley Forge.
The men had nothing to wear. They had no blankets. They had very little to eat. Illnesses were rampant. It was a very, very miserable experience for them.
But in the middle of that winter, Washington finds out that France has decided to sign a treaty with the colonists.
News. This is the kind of news that would make anyone just run about screaming with joy and doing handstands. But Washington is so reserved, and he says that he's received this news with, quote, the most sensible pleasure, unquote.
He also says he is going to wait for the government to approve the treaty before he tells the army.
The fact that he is not going to announce this news immediately to his army speaks to the fact that he was always, always concerned with doing the right thing and with protocol.
By the spring of 1778, General Washington and his army were ready to fight again. General Howe was still in Philadelphia. His behavior as a military leader was sometimes difficult to understand. At times, he was a good commander and a brave soldier. At other times, he stayed in the safety of cities instead of leading his men in battle. The next series of important battles in the American Revolution was led by another British general, John Burgoyne. His plan was to capture the Hudson River Valley in New York State and separate New England from the other colonies. Doing this, the British believed, would make it easier to capture the other colonies. The plan did not succeed. American General Benedict Arnold defeated the British troops in New York. General Burgoyne had expected help from General Howe, but that help never came. Burgoyne was forced to surrender at the town of Saratoga. The American victory at Saratoga was extremely important. It ended the British plan to separate New England from the other colonies. It also showed European nations that the Americans might be able to win their revolution. This was something that France especially had wanted ever since being defeated earlier by the British in the French and Indian War. The French government had been supplying the Americans secretly through the work of America's minister to France, Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was popular with the French people and with French government officials. He helped gain French sympathy for the American cause. After the American victory at Saratoga, the French decided to enter the war on the American side. The two nations signed military and political treaties. Historian Gordon Wood says this alliance created bigger problems for the British.
Because once the French were involved, it turns the thing from counterinsurgency for the British. They're now fighting a world war.
The British immediately sent a message to America's Continental Congress. They offered to go back to a time of better relations. The Americans rejected the British offer. The war would be fought to the end. In 1779, Spain entered the war against the British. And the next year, the British were also fighting the Dutch to stop their trade with America. The French now sent gunpowder, soldiers, officers, and ships to the Americans. However, neither the Americans nor the British made much progress in the war for the next 2 years. By 1780, the British had moved their military forces to the American South. They quickly gained control of South Carolina and Georgia. But the Americans prevented them from taking control of North Carolina. After that, the British commander moved his troops to Yorktown, Virginia. The commander's name was Lord Charles Cornwallis. Both he and George Washington had about 8,000 troops when they met near Yorktown. Cornwallis was expecting more troops to arrive on British ships. What he did not know was that French ships were on their way to Yorktown too. Their commander was Admiral François Comte de Grasse. De Grasse met some of the British ships that Cornwallis was expecting and defeated them. The French ships then moved into the Chesapeake Bay near Yorktown. The Americans and the French began attacking the British with cannons. Then they fought the British soldiers
hand to hand. Cornwallis knew he had no chance to win without more troops. He surrendered to George Washington on October 17, 1781. The war was over. American and French forces had captured or killed half of the British troops in America. The surviving troops left Yorktown playing a popular British song called "The World Turned Upside Down." How were the Americans able to defeat the most powerful nation in the world? Historians give several reasons. The Americans were fighting at home, while the British had to bring troops and supplies from across the ocean. British officers made mistakes, especially General William Howe. His slowness to take action at the start of the war made it possible for the Americans to survive two difficult winters. Historian Gordon Wood at Brown University in Rhode Island says the British also thought more colonists would support them.
When Burgoyne comes down the Hudson Valley, he starts out with an army of 10,000 or so, and he has to hack his way through the woods, and he keeps losing troops to small militia. He counted on more loyalist support than there was, and I think the British miscalculated terribly on that point.
Another reason the Americans won was the help they received from the French. Also, the British public had stopped supporting the long and costly war. Finally, America might not have won without the leadership of George Washington. He never gave up hope. The peace treaty ending the American Revolution was signed in Paris in 1783. The independence of the United States was recognized. Western and northern borders were set. The 13 colonies were free. Now they had to become one nation. That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History, in VOA Special English.